This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad, and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 16 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. Today is Part 3 in our series on J.J. Abrams as a film director, where we are going to be looking at his third movie, Super 8. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we're joined by John from Words with Nerds. How's it going, John?
It's going great. Thank you for inviting me back.
Oh, always. It's always a pleasure to have you here. So
that's a lie, and you know it.
4 out of 5 times, it's a pleasure to have you here. Those are pretty good odds.
Oh, yeah, okay, that sounds fun.
No, seriously, thank you very much. We do appreciate it. So before we get into Super 8 itself, John, what are your thoughts on J.J. Abrams in general?
In general, I think that he's a talented lad with a real knack for getting solid performances out of actors that appear in movies where you're not used to getting the level of emotional depth from their performances that that come across. Like, you know, going through everything, whatever other flaws there are, he is, I would label him an actor's director, because you know that you're going to get good performances out of the actors, the best that they can give you in the circumstances. So I know that I'm always going to enjoy it from that standpoint. And I know that I enjoy his pacing and his edit. You know, his eye is good, with a couple of exceptions of things that he does. But so he's not perfect. But if his name's on something, it's enough to get me interested to go see it.
Fair enough. And then what about his two Star Trek movies? Did you enjoy those?
I enjoyed The Knot Boot in 2009. I found it fresh and different and a good take, again, despite any limitations that there, you know, there were a couple of things where I was like, eh, but it was rebuilding something. So I was looked the other way on a couple of things. Into Darkness completely lost me in the third act. I don't think that I'm unique in saying that at all. I'm not special for making that observation. Okay. But I really
you
felt
might be special in that you identify where that third act begins.
You know, that's an open debate point. No doubt. But like Into Darkness, it was one of those things where I wanted to like it. I really wanted to like it. And even past the first point where I had the cringe, where I went, oh, I wish they hadn't done that, I was still willing to give it a shot. And he did well enough with it to power it to the point where I gave it every last possible opportunity. And until by the end, I was so done with it that I just wanted to just leave the theater and not even say anything to the people I saw it with. It was just like, I don't want to talk about this right now.
All right. So a split decision in terms of his Star Trek work. That's fair enough. Okay. So this movie is another split of his Star Trek work, and that is the thing that he did in between the two movies and the thing that he did directly in between the two movies. It came out in 2011, which is exactly 2 years before Into Darkness and 2 years after Star Trek 09. So it was that thing that a lot of filmmakers do, who you know, filmmakers who are the key holders of franchises, who feel obligated to complete trilogies, or maybe not, and other things like that. Like Christopher Nolan, you know, in between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, he made The Prestige, and in between...
And just to destroy this example, I'm also use Michael Bay.
Michael Bay is the exception, who, you know, he aside from Pain and Gain, he just makes Transformers movies exclusively these days.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, yeah, Nolan, you know, and he also did Inception between Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises, and I can kind of see that thing, because it's like... These guys are sort of known for being auteurs, in a sense, prior to coming onto these franchises, and they don't want to do just Batman movies, even though they do want to do Batman movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it makes sense that, you know, yes, he does want to do Star Trek 2, 12, 13, whatever you want to call it, 12, Into Darkness, but...
Super Star Trek 2 Turbo?
There you go. But before he does that, he wants to do his own thing. And this is, in a lot of ways, his most own thing in terms of his movies.
His most own thing.
His most own thing. Because...
That would really look good on a t-shirt.
It's not a it's not a sequel. It's not a reboot. And it's something which he wrote all by himself. So, in a lot of ways, this is kind of an original work. In a lot of ways, maybe not so much. Max, would you want to give sort of a synopsis or plot breakdown of Super 8?
Of Super 8? It's basically what would happen to E.T. if E.T. was captured by Keys at the beginning of the movie, and then was, like, captive for a little while, then broke out and started doing all kinds of crazy stuff because he was trying to get home.
Yeah.
The end.
And if they gave E.T. access to some, like, steroids, you know.
Well, I assume that he would just, you know... gradually grow. I mean, he was a little guy. He didn't spend a lot of time on it. He had enough time. You know, he bulked up, you know, did some pull-ups in the forest and stuff.
Yeah, maybe he was from like a heavy world, and that's why he was so short to begin with. And then on our world, he bloomed.
Under our yellow sun, he would be crazy. Also, for some reason, invisible sometimes. Sometimes.
At the time that this movie came out, Max and I were working at sister theaters, and we had both screened the movie simultaneously in two different complexes. And shortly after
we had
the movie...
stopwatches and everything.
Yeah, and shortly after the movie ended, I got a text from Max, which I think is probably the only text I've ever received from Max, in which he said, "Cloverfield phone home," which...
Oh, that's hilarious. I am so good at funny.
Yeah, I mean, it was a joke that pretty much everyone had already said, you know, but that was okay. I know that you don't go on the internet, so you thought it was original. So you get an A for effort there, Max.
That's not that I'm not on the internet. So I don't go to movie websites because movies are boring.
Whatever. Anyway, so yeah, and in a lot of ways, I think it is Cloverfield phone home in a sense. You know, it's definitely... supposed to be sort of that style of filmmaking, that Spielberg 70s era style. And, you know, the story is basically about these kids who are making a Super 8 film, a zombie movie, on a Super 8 camera, and they end up photographing accidentally a train crash in which massive destruction occurs and an unknown creature escapes. And then weird things start happening in the town, and it basically goes from there, and what's sort of revealed over the course of the movie, spoilers, I guess, not really, is that, you know, that there is an alien which has been captured by the government, and he's trying to get home. And the government is trying to stop him from getting home.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire movie is told from the perspective of these, you know, 12 or 13-year-old kids who are basically trying to, I don't know, survive at the same time.
They're being lovable little scamps, you know, covering up the secret. You know, they're the holders of the secret.
It's also,
if only they told the parents ahead of time,
right,
and told them what they saw at the train crash site, everybody still would have been powerless before the might of the U.S. military to quarantine their town. But
that's
people would have known beforehand.
That's true.
You know.
It's also locked into that sort of like Spielberg mindset of like the giant thing also is rather significantly about like a family with problems.
Yeah.
Like there's a divorce subplot in several Spielberg movies, which apparently Abrams just thought, I guess I got to do a divorce subplot in order to make this fit.
Yeah, and there's like a single parent thing going on. Yeah. And, yeah.
So but that's the backdrop to the story. That's
I think it's got the obviously the movie is done in the style of Spielberg, you know, those older 70s movies, but the ending is definitely informed by later Spielberg, the guy who likes to pull his punches. You know, would Jaws end with, you know, the shark being set free? You know, it's sort of that. I think it first reared its head in Lost World, where like the monster can't be a monster anymore by the end of it. You know, it's just misunderstood and it just wants to get home. And it's like the thing's eaten half the town, for God's sake. You know, it's okay maybe to just have it be a monster movie by the end instead of having, you know, E.T. build his ship and go home and everybody say, oh, shucks. Well, you know, he ate a few people, but that's all right. You know, like, ugh. I don't know. I feel that it takes some of the best aspects, what made us fall in love with that Spielberg mentality back when he was fresh. But then at the end, I definitely felt like I'd been cheated like a modern Spielberg action movie, where okay. The ending was just not satisfying in the context of the entire plot.
So on the whole, you thought it was okay or what?
I absolutely loved it up until the reveal of the creature in the caves. I thought mm-hmm. that it was far more interesting. It was a far more interesting movie until it hit this point where he felt he had it. It really felt like once it hit that point that he had written himself into a corner and couldn't find a way out. And didn't go to somebody and say, help me out of this. What do I need to change before I commit this to film? And I think that this would have been, and I think you see it, in my opinion, you see it echoed in Into Darkness, where he writes himself into a corner, or the writers in that case wrote him into a corner, and nobody stopped and said, you know what? Let's reconsider this one thing here and turn it around. Let's find some way to make this work better. And I think that's definitely evident in Super 8. Again, I don't think that I'm unique in that, you know, I don't think I have any sort of like special insight. Anecdotally, there are plenty of people I know where they started disliking it earlier in the film. But for me, it's very specifically at that reveal in the caves is the point where the movie ends for me. And the rest of it is loose. It just doesn't feel right.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with your problems with the way that the monster is treated at the end of the movie either. I think they did a good job of setting up that he is, you know, sort of an innocent victim in a sense, and I think that kind of
what do you mean?
Well, yeah. Like that he's an alien just trying to get home and he's scared.
Well, I
don't like you're addressing like something I don't think he actually said. I think what he's saying is that that's a stupid reveal. Like it's wrong, but like that's not interesting, right?
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, yeah,
I do. Mike, you're right. You are keying on something I'm saying. Where if this creature is intelligent enough to put together a ship capable, you know, basically like go to a scrapyard and put together a ship. With his, you know, with the magic cubes and everything that gets him off into space. This is obviously a higher level of intellect. You know, this is. I mean, maybe I missed the point. I mean, maybe it's truly horrifying because maybe I'm informed by the Star Trek mindset of once people achieve, you know, interstellar travel, there's going to be a fair amount of restraint that goes along with their intellect. Like the big creature that can travel across the stars, that can make his own ship. It's not like a rancor came over in a ship and like got out and started eating people. This is the actual like captain of the ship. And so I understand he's been wronged. He needs to get home. But eating the town is the part that really rubs me raw. Because it's if this is a higher intellect, you know, have it live just on like the wildlife. Like it's been eating the bears and the dogs and stuff like that. But instead it's, you know, it's the people. And that I would think that the creature, I don't know. I like, even if somebody wronged me, like I go into a bad part of town and somebody wronged me, I'm not going to view everybody in that city as awful. And I would think that somebody intelligent enough to travel the stars would, you know, could contextualize something and say, you know what, these people are bad, so I'll eat the military people because they're jerks, but I'm going to leave these lowly townsfolk alone.
Is, well, he actually eating them?
Hold on. There are many different levels of this. For one thing, there's an argument that, like, you know, in order, when you travel into interstellar space and you explore the galaxy, you exercise restraint. Well, that's actually a point of view that has alternative positions. I mean, like, it's fairly easy to say we could totally get into interstellar travel without being particularly moral. And just because we have the ability to travel from planet to planet doesn't mean that we do so nicely. It is totally possible. The Star Trek future is a proposition that if we get this good as people, as beings, as societies, then we will be able to basically do almost anything. And the alternative is, like, honestly, give Will and Yutani enough time and they will get us to other planets, no matter how awful they are. And there's no argument that the creature in Super 8 is either one member of either of those camps. But what the indication is to me is that whatever he was when he arrived, he's been through some sort of psychotic break.
I mean, I think that's definitely...
Okay, that's fair. Okay. I can see that, sure.
Like, he's basically been waterboarded for 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Right, so he's just inordinately pissed.
Yes. Okay. He's still got his higher intellect. It's still there. It's just he's on a hair trigger.
Okay. And also, I mean, I think it's kind of partially what you're saying, where, you know, you're like, you know, oh, well, this guy has destroyed the town, so, you know, I know that he's a higher, you know, intelligence or whatever, but enough's enough. You know, maybe we should just take him out before he does any more damage. I think that he probably has that same mindset where it's like, I've been at Area 51 for like the past 50 years. You know, I got to meet, you know, Will Smith that one time, which was cool. But aside from that, it's
could
been
be 40, right?
It's
be
been
40?
Pretty lame. I don't know. They say, oh yeah, because it takes place in 1979, so it wouldn't have been that much time. I think it was he crashed in like. Do they say it was 48 or 49 or 49 or not? I don't know. Anyway, 51. I don't know. Whatever it was. Anyway, he's been there for a few decades.
Yeah.
And
he's been there for a long time, and they're scientists. You know, they have keys on their belts. They're crazy people. They do horrible things to them.
Right. And I see this as being his chance to get away, and he's pretty much just going to run, and whatever gets in his path, it doesn't really stand a chance. And he's just like, screw it, I'm out, guys, you know? And there is even that whole thing where he does sort of perceive us as all being evil, and it's not until, you know, he mind melds with the main kid that he gets the perspective that the kid, you know, actually stops and talks to him and says, hey, look, we're not all jerks. Those guys are jerks. Most of us are just trying to do our thing, and we don't mean you any harm, and you can leave, and, you know, we best of luck to you, you know? And it's at that point where he's like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess I was kind of being a jerk. You know, maybe I should just, you know, get out of here and not...
Well, now that we've resolved the whether or not this creature should stand trial because he's mentally incompetent or not, now that that's been resolved, I think we can...
Is that...
Who cares, man?
The thing is, I enjoy this because this is honestly... Maybe it's a limitation of my vision. Maybe I was coming into it wrong, even with the rewatch for this. Like, that so informed my opinion of the ending that I'm willing to concede that I didn't look... I'll blame Abrams and I'll say he didn't successfully communicate to me as an audience member. But, yeah. But for me... You know, looking at it that way, yeah, okay. Okay, I guess maybe I am being a little... I mean, maybe I needed to walk a mile in the monster's shoes and needed to understand a little bit better where he was coming from. Shame on me.
Well, Mike and I have been through this argument before about whether or not a thing required... Like, if a required reading list is somehow appropriate for a work of art, and because I think everything actually does have a required reading list in a sense, it's okay to blame the audience if they don't get it. It's also okay to blame the creator if they didn't do anything worth getting. And I think the problem with Super 8 is that once you get it, it doesn't really make it better.
Okay, so what were your thoughts on it then, Max? Did you like it?
This is probably the only J.J. Abrams movie that I did not want to leave at any point. Like, most of them, after about 40 minutes, I'm unbelievably bored. And I want to watch almost anything else. Watching Star Trek 2009, halfway in, I was just like, I don't want to be watching this. This is really not going anywhere. And Mission Impossible 3, probably one of the most boring movies that I've seen. Like, modern boring. Not bad. Boring. And Super 8, it wasn't boring. And I think largely that might not be a positive thing, but it was something about it that was interesting, was worth, like, thinking about while watching the movie. And when it was over, I said, you know, honestly, he opened up the box and he had something in there, and it wasn't particularly exciting, but I mean, at least there was something. That's nice. And I think that part of the problem with his movies in general is that when he opens the box, that's what he's got. He's got big E.T. with anger issues.
Well, I mean, in terms of the mystery box element to this and him opening up the box and having something inside, to me, that almost made it worse. Not the fact that he revealed what was inside, but the fact that he
was decided using the box for
that he was using
context.
The box in this context. Because in his other mystery box endeavors, I'm very intrigued by the mystery, and it doesn't really necessarily matter what's in the box, because you know, the question, what's in the box, is what's intriguing about it to me. Mm-hmm. But in this case, the whole time I was watching the movie, first time through, I kept on thinking, what's in the box? What's in the box? And then when he showed me what's in the box, I was like, okay, fine. I mean, I guess I kind of just assumed that's what was in the box, and you're not really giving me anything interesting. And because of that, while I did enjoy the movie the first time through, I definitely thought it was his worst movie, and I still think it's his worst movie. But watching it this time, I wasn't concerned with trying to figure out what was in the box. Instead, I was able to focus on the character-driven part of the story, which, to me, is where this movie excels.
Yeah.
And by not worrying about the monster stuff, I was actually kind of always disappointed when it went to the monster stuff, because I was like, I don't care.
Also, some of it just does not make sense.
Yeah.
There are serious, like, logical problems with some of the monster scenes.
Yeah.
But at least Homer Simpson's in there.
Is it? Is it Homer Simpson?
Yeah, Dan Castellaneta is the used car salesman.
Interesting. He went to our high school.
Yeah.
So. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
The character stuff, the kids, the family problems in this... What must be Southern California?
It's town. Ohio.
It looks like Southern California,
yeah, but I wonder how much of that has to do with our perceptions of Southern California based on Spielberg movies.
I think that they're exactly the same thing. I mean, the whole point is that he's doing Spielberg here.
Yeah.
Like, this is a Spielberg cover band.
Yeah.
In a really weird way. So it doesn't matter where he said it, it's Southern California.
Okay, so then let's talk about the style and everything.
But that's what actually works in this.
Is what?
Is the reality of this place. He actually effectively created an environment that was believable,
that's
which is
true.
Lovely, because outside of this, he hasn't.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, but I mean, this
I mean,
definitely
Star Trek
did
Man,
feel...
Do you really believe that it takes place in an actual... place?
Sure.
I'll give him in the 2009 one.
But this here, yeah, I mean, I really did feel like he captured the essence of 1979, and
remember those days?
There were some
yes
shots.
I do
fetal.
Oh no, I was conscious for them, my friend.
Yeah.
I remember 1979. I was a wee lad, very very young, but yeah, I remember 79 a great deal. And I actually commend him for not relying on some of the more... I think that if we're talking about creation of the world, like, he didn't lean on what so many other filmmakers have leaned on in putting in the cheap the cheap moments of having to stay on Walter Cronkite a little bit too long when he walks by the TV or so, like he's just on.
Yeah.
And it's just Walter Cronkite there, and nobody's saying, "Hey, look at the new Frosted Flakes box," or anything like that. Everything is delivered in the proper context.
It almost felt like it was made in 1979.
Yeah. I definitely believed in this town, and it was because this, like, he definitely made a place that felt familiar. I mean, because, you know, 79 bled into 80 and 81 and all of the, you know, so this aesthetic was there for a little bit longer, and it definitely is authentic. Like the getting the houses right, the popular floor plans of everything, you know, like bunk bed, like everything down to the types of beds people were sleeping in their rooms,
and the way they decorated color them. Palettes.
God.
What was with that orange? Thank God that's gone.
But there, it'll come back.
There's an interesting thing too, and just the way that it was shot and everything like that. It had this almost pseudo documentary feel to it, in the same way that things like E.T. did, where it's like it was more the interaction between the actors more than anything. There was a certain almost Altman-esque quality which lent to a certain feeling of realism in some scenes. And I was really like kind of thinking, like, the 70s were really the first time that movies felt truly authentic. Like, when you go back and watch movies now, obviously there's exceptions. We just talked about Robert Drew on our other show, and you know, he obviously had a huge influence on, you know, cinema verite.
It didn't get big until around this time.
I think it was really people like Spielberg who was like, this is how we do this in a big budget action movie.
Of Spielberg, Lucas, Coppola, those guys,
Scorsese,
in their clubhouse.
Scorsese, yeah, for sure, yeah.
They're No Girls Allowed clubhouse. They spent a lot of time watching like French New Wave stuff, and they learned some lessons there. And at some point, somebody came in there and was like, "Cinema verite," and that's when De Palma was like, "Got it, I'm out."
Yeah.
Yep.
So I mean, I don't know. That was just interesting. But how does this style, would you say, compare to his other movies? Because here's one little thing which I found to be interesting is when this movie was coming out, and Steven Spielberg produced it, and he was talking about how Abrams prior to this had directed Mission Impossible 3 and Star Trek, and he said, you know, in a lot of ways this is Abrams's first movie, because it's his first original concept. He wrote it and directed it himself, and, you know, the other two being sequels or reboots of television series, it
How many times are we going to call J.J. Abrams' project the first time he did blank?
He's done a lot of... There's a lot of first times for him, you know?
Yeah. Sure.
Also,
not really. There's no beach landing moment here. He was there for a while.
Well, I mean,
he was there 6 weeks before D-Day, and he had a camp.
But that's what I'm saying. That's
what
I'm
saying. He already had tickets.
In a lot of ways, I think that this is one of his least original works, because it feels like he is just trying to, while it's not a sequel to a specific franchise or anything like that, feels like it is a sequel to Spielberg's career. You know what I mean?
It could be, though, considered maybe a Cloverfield prequel.
I guess it could, in a sense.
You know, maybe in Cloverfield, you know, the creature's wife is really mad about what happened and came back and wrecked New York.
That's there a possibility. I mean, you know, it does take place in the same universe with the whole Slusho connection and everything.
Exactly.
But how do you feel this stacks up to his other works stylistically? In particular, next to Star Trek, which, you know, this movie fell in between the two.
I think that you're right on hitting on the interaction of the characters, because that, even from the first viewing, was really what really made it come alive for me and made me care up to the point where I stopped caring. And especially the way he constructed the scene of, you know, watching the the film of his mom. And I mean, even the scene where she is done up like the zombie and she keeps coming. And then, you know, he has that, you know, sort of heart stopping moment of, you know, exactly how a boy would react if the girl he was attracted to came up and did something like that, mm-hmm. you know, with, like that frozen half hyperventilating sort of thing. I think that you can see he refines his communication with the actors, I think, between the Star Trek, you know, from Star Trek 2009 to this, especially working with kids, you can see him somehow connect with them on a better level. Like he really, the way that in, you know, because you mentioned Nolan earlier, the way that Inception, you can see how Nolan is really stretching the limits of what he is able to stage technically between Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises, and how, you know, it's a stepping stone up to, you know, the type of stuff he wants to stage for action sequences. With this, I could see very much Abrams maturing in terms of getting those performances out of actors. I mm-hmm. also see him having a moment, especially because of the film's success. What's unfortunate is, and I know it's sort of tired to do this, but the lens flare thing. I think that because of this film's success, this is where the lens flares cement themselves. Because in 2009 with Star Trek, it was a cute affectation. It was sort of, I bought into it, where this was, that was his way of making it seem a little less perfect. In this, though, the lens flares really come into play. Annoyingly, like the first time it really gets annoying is when the sheriff is fueling up at the Kelvin gas station. And the little part of the bottom part of the screen, like it drove me insane, especially on the rewatch, the way that like it framed, like it was just like it was not necessary. And he keeps it through the movie. And I think that because of the movie's success and because of the accolades and because nobody said at this point, hey, you might want to rethink the lens flares a little bit, I think that he winds up going into Darkness and really going overboard with them. And even people that liked Into Darkness are, you know, they're willing to concede that the lens flares were, he conceded that the lens flares were overboard. And I think that that is unfortunate. I think that also there are a couple of moments where the sense of time gets a little bit lost, in terms of, okay, this scene's at night, and then so is this the following morning, or is this going on concurrently? Like there are a couple of points where it gets a little jumbled in the first part of the film.
As far as the lens flares are concerned, you know, I did not have a problem with them here. I mean, like the thing that you're talking about at the gas station, I was like, oh my God, that's so great. Because for one thing, I love lens flares, but also that to me is very much a product of that era of filmmaking, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. And you see it a lot in Spielberg movies and you know, John McTiernan movies.
For a very long time, I considered the anamorphic lens flare with blue streaks of light to be the Spielberg thing.
It was always the big budget thing. It was always the you're watching a big budget summer blockbuster.
When Star Trek 2009 came out, I made a joke to somebody at some point that that J.J. Abrams got all of his lens flares from Close Encounters surplus.
Yeah.
That they just didn't use them all, and he just bought them at some sort of, maybe a garage sale or something. Somewhere in Southern California, probably where the E.T. house was. But, like, I never cared about the lens flares. But it did remind me that back in the first episode of Alias, there's an anamorphic mm-hmm. lens flare there in is. A 4x3 show.
Well, 16x9, but
no,
still.
It was on the 4x3 format. They had anamorphic lens flares in all the formats, even the full frame version. It's absolutely crazy. And then I read about, like, why that is there, why they did this anamorphic lens. Because it was an intentional thing. It was arbitrarily placed in there in order to establish this thing, and that suddenly seemed so insane to me that you would go through the effort of adding a lens flare that really does attract attention. And the thing was, I was talking about the lens flare in the first season of the first episode of Alias.
I remember when you told me about that, and I was like, "You are wrong. there's no way that that's true.
Yeah,
and then I saw it, and I'm like, oh, you're right.
And you know what? It is a crazy thing to do, but it's cool. Also the most interesting thing the first episode of Aliens.
All right, you know what? But whatever. I do love...
It is the prettiest thing in the Star Trek movies. It is really pretty in Super 8. And the problem that I have with it is that the reason people think it's distracting is because it is. Because the rest of it is not compelling enough.
You know what though? That's an interesting argument in and of itself. But
Super 8, I think, actually is almost compelling enough. Like that, it is distracting theoretically.
Lens flares for me were always the mark of sort of like a technological limitation. Like there were certain things as well where. Where they would film something and there would be, like blinds or certain lighting effects where it would stutter. Like it would make my eyes hurt in the background. And lens flares for me were always seemed like just this weird, unavoidable thing. Like, a car's headlights approaching at night in a movie. And for me, it always took me out of the movie. So maybe I'm just always predisposed toward not loving them. But
I think you're like that's not you're not wrong. I mean, that's true. That there was an actual like arc to it. I mean, it's the same thing with any sort of technological like adaptation. Anytime there is an artifact of a thing, at first it is avoided, then it is embraced, and then it just becomes part of the tapestry, and then nobody cares about it anymore. Lens flares hit that point of nobody cares about them anymore about 10 years ago, and J.J. Abrams just used them enough to make them noticeable again.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, I always love them, and they always signal that specific time period because that's when people are shooting anamorphic.
And
that's when the lenses couldn't. I mean, after a while, like in I think the mid 90s,
and that's when they were fully embraced for the first time.
They created,
really embraced.
Yeah, in like the mid 90s, they created anamorphic lenses, which could greatly reduce the amount of lens flares, and that was disappointing.
And a bunch of other guys made lenses that would arbitrarily enhance them.
Yeah, right.
For any situation,
and I just always loved that, and I love it in this movie. And to me, the lens flares in this movie are very different from the lens flares in Star Trek because they are all very much of that sort of time and style.
They are close encounters. They are dead on close encounters.
Whereas in Star Trek, they're much more colorful and much more sort of deliberate. And here they do seem like sort of a product of the limitations of the equipment.
It's kind of weird.
So maybe that's why nobody called it out. Because since it's the whole movie reads as an homage to the movies we all watched growing up. So maybe that's why nobody calls them out. I mean, focusing on the lens flares is why I look at that scene, with the sheriff, and I'm like, oh, I can't believe, that happened, because I know he did it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the first time I watched it, I didn't have that reaction to the lens flares because to me, it almost plays as if that it makes it more authentic since it's supposed to play like an old Spielberg movie. But maybe that's why nobody called him out on it. And maybe that's why it got overboard in Into Darkness, is because he was able to contextualize the overuse of them here. And he didn't understand that it only worked here because of what he was trying to achieve. Because I understand he wrote it. I understand this is, two ideas that he had that he melded together into an even better idea and, all that sort of thing. But, this really feels like somebody who sat down and said, I want to make a Spielberg movie. I don't think there's any way around that.
He didn't sit down. He said that on stage at Comic-Con.
Yeah, I think he said that before when they said, like, I want to do this movie, and hopefully it's an homage to Spielberg movies.
It's basically a Spielberg movie. Have you seen Close Encounters in E.T.?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, like, get, like, a DJ and, like, remix those movies, and you'll get pretty close to what I'm about to do.
Yeah, he flat out said that when they were announcing the project.
But, like, I don't really have a problem with lens flares in this movie, but like the weird thing is like this sort of like this frustrating disconnect, because like in Close Encounters, the lens flares are very, very specifically about something extraordinary. Like they are always a part of alien technology and some sort of revelation. And here it's just like some lights are just too bright, man.
But that's the way. That's the way that movies of the era were. I mean, you look at like John Carpenter movies and. you know, John McTiernan movies, and that's just the way that it was. And,
right.
And I love that.
But there's it's a useful artifact, but when you don't use it to accomplish something, then you're just throwing lens flares at the audience.
To me. Okay, for the record, in terms of, you know, Star Trek collaborators and everything, there were a lot fewer in this than there were in Mission Impossible 3. And the main one, which I messed it up last week, I said that Dan Mindell had shot all of his movies, or Dan Mindell, I don't know how to pronounce his name. And
Dan Mandelbrot.
In fact, Mindell did not shoot this movie. It was shot by Larry Fong, who is primarily, I guess, Zack Snyder's cinematographer, so... but it was edited by Marianne Brandon, Mary Jo Markey, and Michael Giacchino did the music. And the creature was created by Neville Page, who, you know, you can tell because he does the same thing, like, all the time.
Come on, man.
So.
Yeah. Don't go there.
Okay. So anyway, John, any final thoughts on Super 8?
Yeah, as much as I have fixated on some of the negatives... this is actually the movie that I went back to when he was announced as the director for Episode 7 of Star Wars. I specifically pointed back at this and said, if there's anybody I have faith of a big name director that is going to go back and make me feel like I'm watching something that was created by the same guy, by the same team that made the movies I watched growing up, it's Abrams. Like, I have full faith because of Super 8 that he's going to be able to properly use the wipes and the way that the worlds are constructed and the way that things are lit. He's a chameleon, as evidenced by this movie. I think that.
What about the lens flares?
Yeah. Well, I do think that. Maybe he needs to go and make a few more of these original sorts of movies so that he can start to form his own style instead of trying to imitate anybody else's in any way. And because I feel that this is, you know, since this is his most original work, this one was a real opportunity to show what he could do, and he showed he could imitate. But I want to see him make something completely his own, something where I can look at it and say that doesn't, not that it looks like Spielberg and not that it looks like an Apple store, like something that looks like him, something that I can point to and say that looks like him, that's Abrams.
Curly hair and everything.
Yeah, curly hair and everything.
Yeah.
All right. What about you, Max?
I've been bored by a lot of J.J. Abrams' works. I couldn't finish Alias because it just became so incredibly tedious that I wanted to fast forward through entire episodes. And I've seen every episode of Felicity, and I wish I hadn't. Really hard. And I've seen all of his movies, and I can tell you that I don't hate him. I am usually bored, and I'm waiting for somebody to tell him that he should not be making summer blockbusters. He should be making Oscar bait dramas because he would get Oscars for them, because he's good at that, and he's not good at climaxes. He's not good at action movies. He's not good at science fiction or fantasy. He's actually really good at the really tiny small stuff, and the bigger the story is, the more small it feels.
Okay. All right. Well, for me, I still do think that this is his least good movie. While I do enjoy it, you know...
Most bad movie.
Perhaps. I do enjoy it, but the other ones I love. You know, this one I just like. And like, today was the first time that I had seen it since it came out, and... I had never really had a desire to go back and watch it prior to this. I am kind of curious about some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. I was thinking about picking up the Blu-ray, but I didn't. So now because of that, I might not watch it again for a long time. Maybe until Star Wars comes out, because I am intrigued in the same way that you are, John. And I do think that he will be able to capture that style. And also at the same time, you know, figure out a way to make it his own. without making it stand out. Probably nearly as much as the prequels did. But regardless, I do think that it's a decent movie, and I also do think that it's interesting how this is the one that he had written himself, and I know that...
Written is in quotation marks. Though.
You know, I've seen a lot of his TV stuff and other things that he's written, and while I've enjoyed those, I kind of wonder if, you know, bringing in people like Kurtzman and Orsi as collaborators might actually be beneficial to him as a director. And I'm very curious to see what a collaboration between him and Lawrence Kasdan will look like. So I guess that's my thoughts on Super 8.
I'm waiting for him to stop diluting everything with his desire to make everything boring.
Okay, Lost was not boring.
But he didn't really do anything on that.
No,
either.
It wasn't boring.
Die Hard Losty from beginning to end right here. That's his best thing. That's what he will always be known for.
See, the funny thing about that is basically that means that you were a fan of like five different shows.
Yes.
And like at no point did you think, wow, what was this show when it started? Oh, there was a plane crash. And that was a magical cork in an island.
Yeah.
Okay, be careful of spoilers because I've still only seen season one of that show. So. I will
gladly ship my Blu-ray set to you so that you can watch them all.
I've actually got the Blu-ray sitting right here just waiting to be watched. I just haven't had the time.
Lost is
God, man, what are you waiting for?
Because if I told you the entire plot, you would think, that's stupid. Made all of that up.
The thing is,
I am going to come through this microphone. You're going to have words, man.
Have you guys seen This Is 40?
No.
No.
Okay, because in that movie...
I'm not going to.
Like throughout that
never
movie,
in my life.
Maude Apatow's character, the daughter, she's just watching. She's binge watching Lost throughout the entire movie, and then she gets to the end.
Brought this up a few times,
and she basically ruins the ending of Lost in the movie.
Yeah,
and then she becomes like very, very sort of like down, and becomes sort of like a typical teenager, and then they start blaming J.J. Abrams for her mood, and it's funny. But anyway, regardless.
No, I blame ABC.
Okay, so regardless, John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, they can find me on the internet on Twitter. I have a cozy little corner there at Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE. And they can also find me weekly on a podcast called Words with Nerds, available on Stitcher, iTunes, Podbean, and anywhere that library books are sold at half price.
All right. Cool. Well, thank you very much for joining us, as always, and you're welcome back anytime.
Indeed.
Excellent. I'm gonna hold you to that.
Well, that was fun talking to John about Super 8, but that's not the only thing we're talking about here on Trek FM. So here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Everything that we do has to exist inside of this little box.
This window,
yeah,
if you will.
Right, and you can do whatever you want inside there, but once you step outside... You know, it's the real world.
Earl Grey.
That's, you know what I mean? And then Star Trek V is all about crapping all over the rest of the movies that just came out.
Axanar, the official podcast.
When you're in the edit bay, as soon as you put one image next to another, it's this instant gratification. It's this great creative jolt, which happens every time you start juxtaposing your images. And when you start seeing things fall into place, it's really galvanizing and it's really thrilling, actually. And I love feeding off that kind of energy.
The Ready Room.
Well, you know, time is not really linear, Char. So the monkey, he's always been there and he always will be.
I take the Janeway stance on time travel. It gives me a headache.
The Orb.
Batman also creates a contingency plan for all the other superheroes just in case something goes wrong with them. So
what does he do for the Wonder Twins, for example? Like, how is he going to take them out?
I think he just separates them eternally so they can't smack their hands together.
To the journey! We have like a whole bunch of geek aliens, like they're wearing their own superhero t-shirts, they're eating Hot Pockets, they have headphones on, and they're all in their own little, you know, 24th century room, but they're like, dude, I totally just pwned the Voyager.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
and underlines the goal of Prexy Gail Berman to re-energize the pipeline while revitalizing the PAR brand with top-tier talent such as Abrams. I love trades.
You have
They're
no
so...
idea what you're saying at this point.
Warp 5.
He can put her mind at ease about these kinds of things because he can just, you know how Trip is. Like, let's have some catfish and, just hang out. You know,
I was just thinking that. Continuing mission.
We actually spoke with CBS legal team, and that was one of the things that we had told them, is that all of our visuals were all original scenes. All of our animation was going to be original. All of our music would be original. So we would not be stealing any content from the original era. Mm-hmm. And they liked that a lot.
Literary treks.
And I just love that because it is very true. You know, Picard in some ways kind of has that Yoda-ness about him where he will kind of speak in a riddle and he wants you to figure it out.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows to get in on the daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory for Xbox and Zune, or you can stream them from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. So we have some feedback this week.
Feedback?
The first time someone sent us a message through the Trek FM form, which is kind of cool. This one is from Gene. He says...
From G?
Gene.
Oh, Gene.
Yeah, like Gene, the dancing machine.
Or Roddenberry?
Oh,
really?
There's that one too.
Honestly? Really? That's your... What is wrong?
Anyway, he says...
Not late enough for you to make that kind of weird...
He says that he's in the JJ-verse. And he says, "Hi, Mike and Max. Love the show. Big fan. I am looking for a little context and perspective. I would like Max to give some examples of movies that he likes and why he likes them. I think that will help me better understand Max's opinions about the movies that you review. Also, I was listening to your Damon Lindelof episodes and am curious to know more about Max's opinion that Star Trek should die. I am intrigued. Also, thanks, Mike, for your Star Trek 2009 commentary. It was awesome. I am often puzzled by fan reactions to the 2009 film and appreciate the praise you gave it." All right, so let's
what
start off.
What are you talking about?
Well, we'll get into that.
But did you do that thing?
I did it.
When did you do that?
Why?
When?
It came out right before we started our JJ thing, and I forgot to talk about it on here. But we'll talk about that in a second. Let's talk about your thing first. Okay, so this is a question which a lot of people ask, and I know the answer to this, but what are some movies that you like? Because
like
there's
movies.
A lot of stuff that you don't like.
I like most movies.
What are some movies that you think are good?
There are not that many.
Not that many. But Aliens?
Sure. Off the top of my head, I can think of a few movies, but they're all sort of like connected to what we've been recently talking about. I mean, it's like certainly, I mean, Die Hard, Star Trek 2, Aliens.
Shaun of the Dead.
Sure.
Star Wars.
Yeah,
Episode 4, New Hope, The Empire Strikes Back.
Sure.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I'm trying not to go down a particular path. I'm trying to
spread it around.
Like, Lucasfilm movies, except for the Ewok adventures.
Here's a weird one. My Dinner with Andre, right? Big fan of My Dinner with Andre?
No. This is the thing. I'm not. Okay. I'm just going to make a point of this, okay? I do not care about what I like.
Okay.
What I like has no bearing on how good a movie
is. And that's an important thing to understand with Max.
And I find it very frustrating when people say, I really like that movie. It's really good.
Okay. So movies that you think
are
good.
There's a fundamental difference between what you like and what is good.
Movies that you think are good.
I'm only talking about movies that I think are
good. Okay. All right.
And I would include movies that I don't even particularly like. Godfather movies is a good example of that.
So.
Those are mainly the biggest example because they're like as good as... how much I hate them.
Okay. But as someone who has known you for the past decade or whatever, I mean, I would say that the movies which I hear you come back to again and again are things like Aliens, Shaun of the Dead, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Die Hard. Those are like the big ones to me.
Well, I would say I go back to Aliens on a regular basis.
Yeah.
As an example. Because like what is good about Aliens is actually very informative about like the nature of like quality storytelling, and especially when you're dealing with a franchise. Yeah. And we're usually talking about franchises and sequels and stuff, and Aliens is probably the best example of somebody coming into a franchise, bringing in new life without breaking anything, and in fact enhancing it significantly. I cannot think of a better example of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it, you know, James Cameron did that with Aliens, and, like, he actually also did it with Terminator 2. Different situation, because he kind of started it, but, like, there's a lot to be learned there about what it is that you're doing when you're making a thing in a franchise. And James Cameron seemed to have a handle on it that nobody else seemed to. It seemed like many franchises either lived or died or succeeded or failed, and sequels would come and go, and the ones that would stay were sort of chance. It was sort of like luck of the draw, but Cameron actually like spelled out exactly what you do. You enhance it, you change the thing that came before, but you don't break it.
Yeah.
And when you think about that, you can actually figure out why so many people get it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They break the thing that came before, like Alien 3.
Yeah.
Or Star Wars prequels.
Okay.
So or Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Deal with it. Deal with it. Deal with it.
Okay. So moving on to the next thing about why you think Star Trek should die.
I don't know what that's about.
I mean, I would assume, I don't remember the context in which you said this, but I would assume that it's similar to what you've been talking about in regards to, let's say, Star Wars recently on our other show, mm-hmm. Off Topic, where you're talking about franchises which are, you know, no longer being made because there's something to add to the story, but they're being made because it's a franchise and there's money to be had.
Yeah, I think that's a significant problem. I mean, it's essentially like anytime something becomes a valuable commodity, essentially the people with resources to control it take control of it, and whatever it was is lost. I mean, it's sort of an anarchic concept. I mean, like it's sort of what happens with anything that experiences a kind of success that is largely defiant in nature. I mean, punk rock was sort of the exact same thing. It was defined by being essentially revolutionary. It's throwing out the rules, being something new, and you give them enough time, and the people with the power will eventually turn it into something that they can use.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just how it goes. And generally speaking, like, everything works this way. Every franchise that goes for long enough eventually becomes something that people use to increase their power, like religion in the entirety of human history. It starts as a revolution, and then it becomes the thing that everyone agrees on, and then the people with the resources to control it take control of it, and it's no longer a thing that makes anything good. It becomes essentially a meaningless property that is used primarily to control things. And Star Trek hit that in 2009. And it was largely because they said, Star Trek was a series that on a regular basis said to its audience, you're wrong, and we don't like a lot of things about you. If we got rid of that, it would be really good for money. Okay. We could make a lot more money if we stopped saying to the audience that they were doing things wrong. One of the nicest things about the original series and The Twilight Zone was that they, on a regular basis, said to their audience, you are bad. Here are some things we don't like about you. Please change them. Get back to us. Like, maybe email, text, don't call. We have weird hours.
All right. So hopefully that's clear. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but then again, I've, you know, kind of heard this numerous times over the past decade or so.
I find it strange that people don't think about this on a regular basis, because it's sort of like, it is everything. Everything works this way. Like, literally every time, like, something becomes profitable, it gets controlled by people who use it entirely to increase their power. And it's the exact same thing with, I mean, hell, it's oil, you know? It's anything that gives somebody power, it will eventually land in the possession of one group or an individual, and it will become primarily a tool of destruction. Okay. And I think Star Trek has, in 2009, they pulled out all the things about it that alienated people, like the whole thing of saying, we don't like some things about you. Some people found that alienating. When you pull that out, you end up with a very powerful tool of destruction. Of course, it wasn't supposed to be. It was supposed to be something good, because Star Trek is the Genesis device, and Paramount is Khan.
Okay, well, I don't necessarily agree with that analysis. While I see what you're saying, I don't agree that that applies to Star Trek, but I won't get into that now. What I will say is that, yes, you can go and listen to my commentary for 2009 Star Trek, which can be found in the master feed right here on Trek.fm. I did this. My goal was, you know, I oftentimes talk about how I think Star Trek 2009 is the best of the franchise, and people always look at me like I'm crazy for saying that, which is fine, but that doesn't happen with, like, really anything else. Like, people who say that Voyager is their favorite, or people who say that Enterprise is their favorite, they just, people, you know, just say, like, oh, that's interesting.
I don't say that.
Well, I know, but you're the exception to the rule here. You know, most people, you'll always find people be like, oh, I can understand that. I can see where you're coming from. I don't agree with it, but I see where you're coming from. But with me and
that's
Star Trek...
That's true with me and, like, Next Gen and Original Series.
Okay, but for me with...
Those are the only ones.
With Star Trek 2009, you know, I'm like, you know, I think that this is my favorite. And people are just like, what? Like, have you seen other Star Trek? I don't understand. So I did this commentary to just kind of explain that, yes, I have thought this through, and, you know, I wasn't trying to change anyone's mind. I was just trying to say this is why I think this, and I have thought about it, and I do see the flaws. And, you know, putting all that together, I do think that this is my favorite Star Trek movie. And my goal was to release this prior to us doing the J.J. Abrams series so that it didn't become a thing that I had to explain all the time with this series. And I was expecting to get a lot of backlash for it, honestly, and I've gotten nothing but positive feedback, you know, even from people who don't agree with me, and I really do appreciate that, you know. So thanks for listening, Gene. I do appreciate it, and thanks to everyone else who's listened to it too. And if you do want to hear it, it's in the master feed. It does get a little slow at the end because it's really freaking hard to talk to yourself for over 2 hours, but I tried.
Not if you do different voices.
I should have done that next time.
I hate the situation that you put me in whenever you're talking about this, because I hate being on your side when you're wrong.
Okay.
Because they're wrong for why they hate it.
Okay.
It's bad the way almost everything is.
Okay.
It's just not good.
Okay. Anyway, thanks
like
for...
Like Voyager.
Okay. Anyway.
Deal with it.
Thanks for sending the feedback, Gene. We really do appreciate it. And if you want to send us feedback, please do so. You can do it like Gene did by finding the little button on Trek FM, or you can just email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com, or you can hit us up on Twitter at comtrackstars, or you could post a review on iTunes for us, which would actually be greatly beneficial to us. You can do that just like Aslan16 did. That's a Lord of the Rings reference?
Aslan?
No, that's Chronicles of Narnia. Yeah. Ah, whatever, same thing.
No. That is so inexcusable. That's like saying that Star Trek 2009 is the best in the series.
Okay, all right. Anyway, Aslan 16.
One of these days I end up getting around to building hell.
Okay.
I'll put your name on the list.
Anyway, Aslan 16 says, setting the track record on Trek Stars. It's always fascinating to find out what Trek people have done outside of Trek. I can't thank Mike and Max enough for all the work they must put into this excellent show. Each podcast episode is a great and informative listen. Whether you're a Star Trek fan or just want to learn more about writers, directors, etc. in TV and film, this podcast is for you. Thank you very much, Aslan16. We really do appreciate it. And, you know, those iTunes reviews do help us with getting seen by more people, I guess. So thanks.
Indeed. Thank you.
Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to support our sponsor, who helps us bring commentary, Trek Stars, to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week, from classics to current bestsellers and even some of the most famous Star Trek books like Spock's World. Audible has something for everyone. They've even got Steven Spielberg, a biography. If you want to know about the producer of Super 8 and the guy who inspired everything in the movie, check out this book. It's written by Joseph McBride. It's narrated by Edward Lewis. And it says, "The most successful director in movie history, Steven Spielberg has been responsible for such box office blockbusters as Jurassic Park, Jaws, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and the Indiana Jones trilogy." Or quadrilogy.
And also all the bad movies he made afterwards.
And yet throughout much of his career, Spielberg's work has been undervalued by critics who have questioned his emotional maturity and intellectual seriousness. It was not until he made Schindler's List in 1993 that he was widely recognized as a serious filmmaker.
The end.
Until now.
Oh, too bad.
Much about Spielberg's personality and the forces that shaped it has remained enigmatic, in large part because of his tendency to obscure and mythologize his own past. In this full-scale, in-depth biography, Joseph McBride reveals hidden dimensions to the filmmaker's personality and explains how deeply personal even his most commercial work has been. With the same breadth of research and clarity of insight that characterized his acclaimed biography of Frank Capra, McBride has gone in search of the true Steven Spielberg, interviewing more than 300 of the director's friends and associates, many of whom had never spoken about him before. And this was written in 1997, so it'll be an interesting perspective. And you can get it for free since you listen to Trek FM.
At this point in the history of America, Jurassic Park still has no bad movies in its series.
Except
for maybe the first one.
Well, it still hasn't, but yeah.
Sort of the first one.
As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've yet to read and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek FM. And lastly, there's one more way you can directly help us keep Commentary Trek Stars coming to you each week, and that's by adopting some aliens. Well, illustrations, anyway. If you go to trek.fm/donate, you'll find 8 original alien illustrations by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork you see on our website. They're available as both badges and art prints, and there are different contribution levels for you to choose from. Just let us know which you would like and in which format. Again, you'll find them at trek.fm/donate, and your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring you the show each week. They don't have any Cloverfield aliens or any ETs, but you know,
or Canadians.
They don't have Canadians either, but they do have Romulans, so there's that.
Same thing.
Yeah. All right, well, that's it for Super 8, and we will be back next week to recap our look at J.J. Abrams as a director.